readings this morning come from the books of Isaiah and John, starting with Isaiah chapter 25, verses 6 to 9. In Jerusalem, the Lord of Heaven's armies will spread a wonderful feast for all the people of the world. It will be a delicious banquet with clear, well-aged wine and choice meat. There he will remove the cloud of gloom, the shadow of death that hangs over the earth. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away all tears. He will remove forever all insults and mockery against his land and people. The Lord has spoken. In that day, the people will proclaim, "This is our God. We trusted in him and he saved us. This is the Lord in whom we trusted. Let us rejoice in the salvation he brings." And reading from the book of John, chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. The next day, there was a wedding celebration in the village of Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the celebration. The wine supply ran out during the festivities, so Jesus' mother told him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman, that's not our problem," Jesus replied. "My time has not yet come." But his mother told the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Standing nearby were six stone water jars used for Jewish ceremonial washing. Each could hold 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus told the servants, "Fill the jars with water." When the jars had been filled, he said, "Now dip some out and take it to the master of ceremonies." So the servants followed his instructions. When the master of ceremonies tasted the water that was now wine, not knowing where it had come from, though of course the servants knew, he called the bridegroom over. "A host always serves the best wine first," he said. "Then when everyone has had a lot to drink, he brings out the less expensive wine. But you have kept the best until now." This miraculous sign at Cana in Galilee was the first time Jesus revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Thanks be to God for the readings from his holy word.
Epiphany is a season in the church calendar which, depending when Easter falls, can span anything from 4 to 9 weeks. It stretches from the Feast of the Epiphany, which we mark on the 6th of January, right through to Shrove Tuesday. And the gospel stories we revisit during Epiphany describe different events and miracles that reveal the divinity of Jesus. Today's focus on the second Sunday of Epiphany is the famous story of the wedding in Cana of Galilee. And it happens to be a fascinating account, both from an historic and from a symbolic point of view. And with just a little bit of detective work, there are even some interesting things we can learn and deduce from the story about the culture and practices of the time. From the historical side of things, a wedding celebration at that time would take place over a week. And during that period, the host family would open their home to as many invited guests and well-wishers as possible. Hospitality was always the responsibility of the hosts. To run out of food and drink, not to be able to provide for your guests, would usually have resulted in severe embarrassment, not just for the bride and groom's families, but for the wider extended family too. Shame versus honour were important social drivers in the culture at that time. And that, of course, was exactly the scenario that was playing out in John's account. And it became the background to the miracle that Jesus performed. Now, biblical scholars and historians are very often interested in the smallest of details in these accounts. And in recent years, there's been quite a bit of interest by scholars in the types of ceremonial water jars that John mentions here in verse 6. And on that very subject, the theologian Richard Buckham notes three things. The first was to do with the impurity laws which were laid down in the Old Testament in the book of Leviticus. According to ancient Jewish ritual law, vessels that were made of pottery, of clay, could very easily become impure. And if and when that happened, they could no longer be used and they had to be broken or in some other way destroyed. Stone, on the other hand, wasn't subject to the same laws. It was believed that stone couldn't become ritually impure like clay. And so, although stone jars would have taken more time and money and effort to make, they could be used time and time again, even if they came into contact with something that was considered to be unclean. So the fact that John mentions them specifically suggests that this was a household in the account that was concerned with purity, and it may even have been a priestly household. The second thing of interest about stone jars is that they had to be carved from a single piece of stone. And actually, in 2017, archaeologists discovered a 2,000-year-old chalk stone quarry, a cave between Nazareth and Cana. Only the fourth such discovery of its kind, in actual fact. Buried in the cave was the evidence of what had been made there. There were piles of the rounded, hollowed out insides of what would have been drinking vessels. Sizable pots, though, and storage jars needed a kind of lathe that the Romans used when working with larger pieces of stone or pillars. So again, with a bit of detective work, the fact that John mentions those jars here has helped scholars to narrow down the likely time frame in which the jars could well have been made. And thirdly, we might logically assume that because the stone jars were costly to produce, they would have been, or they might have been, important decorative objects. But back in 1970, when archaeologists excavated a house which had been burned to the ground, way back in the first century, there were stone pots that were discovered in the working areas of the house. And to the archaeologists, that indicated that these pots were very much of a practical use. They weren't just for show. So what else can we learn from John's account? Well, we know that it wasn't deemed proper for a Jewish mother to make a request or a demand of an adult male, for example, her son. Hence, it's not surprising that when Mary is recorded as saying, what else can we learn from John's account? Well, we know that it wasn't deemed proper for a Jewish mother to make a request or demand of an adult male, a son, for example. Hence, it's not surprising that what Mary is recorded as saying is a statement and not a question. She simply wouldn't have asked Jesus for more wine, so instead she states a fact. They have no more wine, and leaves the statement hanging in the air. And then there's the Greek word that's used for the wine running out. And the meaning of that word is actually quite nuanced. It can describe two things, a lack of quantity, as in there not being enough of something, and it can suggest a lack of quality, as in something not being good enough. And John captures both these senses of the verb in his narrative. Mary points out the obvious, that the wine has run out. And the master or steward of the celebration is then surprised about the fine quality of the wine once the water has been drawn out of the jars. The master, though, has no idea where the wine has come from, and it's the bridegroom who's given the credit. Once again, everything is very proper, leaving the bridegroom's all-important honour intact. Jesus doesn't invite attention nor credit. It's Jesus' first miracle. And in one way, it seems pretty low-key. It's not raising the dead. It's not healing the sick. It's not walking on water, and it's not feeding multitudes of hungry people. John uses the word sign in relation to all of Jesus' subsequent miracles. And interestingly, he also uses the word sign in this case too. So we can probably assume that he considered this event important. It was obviously important enough to record. But a sign of what? Well, weddings then, as now, were a great cause for celebration, the extravagance, the feasting, the sharing, the enjoyment of the occasion. And the image of a heavenly banquet was sometimes used to describe the glory of the age to come. Isaiah, for example, as we heard, prophesied a future when God would bring about an end to tears and suffering, when death would be swallowed up forever, and when God would provide for all people a rich feast of food and wine. And it was a wonderful image of God's grace and benevolence and provision, of what God would do and would provide for his people. So when Jesus turned water into wine, it was a sign. It was a sign announcing, this is what the future looks like. God's future is an outpouring of love and generosity and abundance and grace. But more than that, that future has already begun. That future is here. That future has arrived. That future is tangible and will be made evident in the life and work and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. It's not some distant endpoint in the future. It's actually here, and it begins now. God's future has arrived in the shape of Jesus Christ, as we often say, breaking into time and space. Look hard at this miracle, and I think we will see something wonderful. Not just John's account of a once upon a time wedding in Cana, but a glimpse of God's gift to each and every one of us, for which we say, thanks be to God.